It's Saturday, January 7th, 2012, and you're listening to episode 255 of Fear the Boot, a show about tabletop role-playing games and a little bit more. Running time for this episode is 48 minutes. Welcome to Fear the Boot. My name is Dan.
My name's Chad.
This is Wayne.
This is Johan.
My name is Pat.
And this is Chris.
Before we get down to our topics for today, I've got something here that I want to show off here. So for those of you who are not on our forums, shame on you. But secondly,
oh, you did get it.
I did.
She's been asking me if you got it.
So on our forums, we do a Secret Santa thing where basically there's a guy who swaps everyone's names around, asks, you know, who are you willing to trade with? Are you willing to ship overseas or not overseas and things like that? And this year, my name was drawn by a girl who goes by Lunar on the forums. And she did a picture for me of my Gnarl, during one of the theater performances where he's doing that cheap theater trick of clutching a wooden sword by his side, but at a profile view to where he looks like he's being stabbed. And it has the red ribbons. He has tongues like hanging out like a dead dog. And he's got these red ribbons coming off of it to simulate the blood, exactly how we used to describe it in the games. Mm-hmm. So, Lunar, I want to thank you. This is really awesome. And
she does a good job of picking gifts for us. That dice bag that I've been using for Battletech, the little Batman one, came from her, too.
You know, I don't think I was even aware she's an artist. I'm going to see if I can find a gallery or something of hers to link in the show notes with this. So if anyone's out there looking for commission work and presuming she even does that, then you might want to consider her for your character sketches, because this is great.
Yeah, it's really well done. Excellent.
I fully intend to get this one framed and added to the collection of commission art that I have framed over there but need to hang up still.
She contacted me.
I have a bunch of art today. My podcast. What the f-? There we go. Even my own machine doesn't let me talk when I want to talk. Holy crap. I was just trying to say, I have actually hung up a bunch of artwork in my podcast booth today, as a matter of fact. So I dug out some of my old FOSSA posters. And even
I
some
did see
some
the map
custom
of the Inner Sphere behind you.
Yeah, I was going to ask you if that was an Inner Sphere map behind
that's the,
you.
That's the 3025 era. I even hung up some of the custom or the original drawings of some of the mechs that went in the techno readouts and from the Mercenaries Handbook that I got when FOSSA collapsed. I can't remember who the developer was at the time. I think it might have been Scott Jenkins. He sent me a bunch of stuff just because he was nice.
I've got a piece of original art somewhere in this room I need to find because I lost it and a listener sent it to me. It is a piece of original art from the FOSSA days. It's similar to the one in Technical Readout 3026 of the female mechware. It's not the same, though. I lost it. Like, it's a really cool piece of art. And it's in this room somewhere. It's not like it got thrown out. But it's...
You know who you got that from?
No, I do not recall. If I could dig it up, I could tell you who drew it, where I got it from. It's in one of these paper piles somewhere, and I will find it here at some point.
I'm pretty sure I gave that to you.
You may very well have. So I'm not saying you didn't. But it was pretty cool, and now it is buried somewhere in this room.
Now it is pretty gone.
All
you
right.
Know, Lunar, getting back to the Gnarl drawing there, Lunar was asking me when she drew your name. She's like, oh, man, I don't know what to give him. You know, what do you, I hear some of my ideas. What do you think he'd like? And one of the ideas she pitched is like, well, I'm thinking about, you know, doing this Gnarl drawing. I don't know if he'll like it. I'm like, are you kidding me? He will love it. And he's like trying to decorate his house with original artwork and stuff.
You know, and it's funny because I was even contemplating getting a commission of Gnarl. There are only two or three characters I have played that I liked enough to want to immortalize in commissions. And he was one of the ones I was thinking about adding to that list. And then this came in, which I guess kind of answers the question for me.
I love that the cardboard that's holding this flat has Cthulhu drawn on it.
Yeah, so for those of you that are sitting at home wondering, like, okay, really, what does this have to do with me? The point of it is our forum community is awesome. If you're not a part of it, you are missing out on a lot of great people. Not just people who are good gamers, but people who legitimately
are
good people, do a lot to reach out to and take care of and get to know one another. And that's something that if you are not a part of, you ought to at least consider.
The phrase internet family gets bandied about quite a bit on our forums.
With far more accuracy than anywhere else I've ever seen that phrase bandied about.
Mm-hmm. All right, so let's move into a gaming topic here. Actually, a series of gaming topics. We're going to start with one. This is going to lead to two related tangents.
Now, these are all Wayne topics, right?
Yes, Wayne kicked this one off.
Now, so if this episode sucks...
We will blame
it's Chris. Chad's fault for driving me here.
But
no, there you go.
And Chris's fault for being old.
Yes.
And Pat's fault for not talking. Mm-hmm. And Johan's fault for it being that time of the month. But Dan and I, we're clear.
Wayne brought the beef, and I'm here to moderate. So. Wayne, we'll cover as much of this as we can. Anything we don't cover, we'll pick back up again in our next regular episode. There's likely going to be a bonus episode in here somewhere. Do you want to kick this one off, or do you want me to?
I can kick this off.
Okay.
So our topics all spawned around the fact that my character in Battletech got his head kicked in by a bigger, heavier mech.
Yes, literally.
Literally.
He was sitting in the cockpit, and a much larger mech kicked that cockpit and crushed him alive in it.
So as I was walking around the as I was walking around the basement looking at other minis, trying to figure out what I wanted to do, exactly what I wanted to do with my next character, it got me wondering of how do you handle character death in game? And I don't mean whether characters should die or any of that. I just mean the actual logistics of when a character dies. What do you do for the rest of that session? What do you do with that player? You know, when do you take the time to create the new character? How do you introduce the new character? All of those in that moment things.
And I like the way you're framing this because of the fact that whether character should die is something that we've covered in the past. We may do again, but that's not where I want this discussion to go. We'll just leave that out. So whether your characters or party should die or not, different topic for a different episode.
Yeah. And in
let's
this
just
case,
deal with it happened now yeah. what?
And in this case, I'm actually happy that it happened because I like my new character better anyway. I think the campaign has gotten better for it.
Right. And you guys made the consensus before the game started that you wanted character death to be a real possibility. Yep. And Battletech does provide a reroll mechanic through something called Edge.
Which Wayne did not have.
No. I think your first question is a good one. Is what does that person do for the rest of the game? I think this is going to somewhat probably come down to how the person has taken that character's death. And I don't mean this in some Blackleaf way. What I mean is games are storytelling. And just as your mood kind of changes as you're watching a really good movie, your mood is going to change throughout the course of the game. So is that character death a moment that has given that person kind of pause, agitation, whether at the GM or the bad guy? Is it more kind of, you know, they're really gunning to get back in the action? My first impulse would be if this person does not have a backup character concept ready to go, then I would try and throw them a fairly well-established NPC.
Like, so everyone else around the table was taking it harder than I was because I was just excited. I had my first character death in a game.
So I don't know which was more depressing or tragic for our party as a whole was, like, for the people, not the characters, because the characters, the most tragic thing was losing your character, you know, a person and then other team members. But for the players, which was more tragic, your character's death or losing that dropship that we talked about the first time, which, I mean, the point wasn't the dropship, it was the defeat. We got handed this massive, massive defeat. And again, when Wayne's character died, the thrust of the story, the feel of the story was that we won, but
it was such a
what
pyrrhic
cost?
Victory.
Yeah, it was like
an unbelievably pyrrhic victory.
The price that was paid was not worth it. And what was even worse about it was that there were dissenting voices to the plan. You know, there was a plan that was leading up to this, and the plan altered and changed, and there were people who kind of debated against the change, and then there were people who were debating against the plan going forward in the first place. So, like, there's a lot of in-character tension going on about who made what call right and who is responsible for whose death.
And as a player, when my character died at that point, I didn't want to do anything to stop that moment from going on. I felt kind of awkward because I'm the player without a character at that point, so I'm trying to not interrupt what's going on. I don't think I would have wanted in that situation to jump into an NPC because I wanted to see these players.
The NPCs were at a very critical moment because, as Chad said, there was a great deal of dissent about the plan. Wayne's character was married, and his wife is their tactical officer, so she was aware of the battle. When he died, John, as the new commanding officer, shut off her ability to talk on the comm channels to keep her from freaking out. Also,
John does know how to handle his women.
And also, as Chad said, by the end of the battle, their flag was flying, but if you looked at the inventory of equipment lost and people killed, the only party that won was Khorne. Blood for the blood god and skulls for the skull throne. I mean, he was the only victor there.
Yeah.
But
and Beth, who left the field untouched.
Yeah, that as well. I think my, as I said, my first impulse would be to hand the person an NPC. If that's not possible, either because there's no NPC that's workable, it's just not expedient given the situation, then I think the next best thing you can do is get the person back into the action as soon as it's feasible. In this case, you had a backup character in mind, which worked out well. Now, sometimes people don't. Sometimes, quite frankly, that's a setup for disaster.
This is the first time I've ever had one in mind.
Having a backup character in mind is just as bad as talking about another campaign, because you're sometimes spelling the doom of your current campaign by looking at the new shiny.
And I think that actually is something that really happened with Wayne here, because you've had your cousin, or well, I forget
actually,
the relationship.
No, I didn't.
I thought you'd had that in mind for
I knew
for
I wanted
sessions.
To have a backup character ready, but I didn't actually create his personality or anything about him until my character died.
His existence,
died.
Though, was
His existence was there.
And, okay, that was then is tantamount to it, because, like, for me, I don't have a backup character in mind. Why? Because I don't want this one to die. I want to play it, so I don't even have that in the wings.
I was creating
I did kind
a
of see that a little bit with you,
game,
because
but...
you're saying that I was fine with this. I was fine that he died, yeah. Because I was kind of tired of this character, and he played his course. And I think that was, you're sort of playing in your sort of self-fulfilling prophecy, I think, a little bit there.
Well, I guess it's not a matter of this was the new shiny, because I intentionally didn't give him his personality yet, because I didn't want him to be the new shiny. Mm. But it was a matter of, for some reason, this character wasn't clicking with me. I don't know what it was, but the character I was playing, the idea initially sounded interesting, but the more we got into the game, it just didn't feel right. So I didn't mind getting a fresh start, having had a chance to actually play a little Battletech and realize where I would want to do stats and things like that and figure out what I did and didn't like. In the end, I think I'm going to enjoy the campaign much more having had that happen. But it wasn't one of those new shiny things, because I intentionally didn't give a personality to him yet. Mm-hmm. That's why once he was in there, I had to kind of develop that on the fly, because I didn't want to look forward to the new character.
Yeah.
But I wanted to have a way in. I didn't want to end up having a character dead and have no way to come in with the new character.
See, I don't know. The new shiny thing, I understand it to a point, but I have a backup character for this game. He is written into the background of my current character, the 5-page long, gigantic background that I made. And I have a fully developed personality for him. I have his mech picked out. I have history. I've talked it over with Dan. I've cleared almost everything with Dan except handing him the mech sheet. And I have in mind what he can play. I could press the pause button on this character and start playing my backup character and then switch back to the other one. And I don't have a problem with it. I'm not sitting here going, oh, I got to play this other guy because he's so cool. It's like, he's there. And, I might get to him eventually. I like my current character. I think that's the thing, is that the new shiny will only eclipse your current character.
If the current character sucks.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. And I'm really enjoying my current character a lot. And I actually think that it kind of enhances my current character, because there is this really fleshed out NPC.
I don't think, though, your character sucking is the only possibility. Look, several people in the past month or two have sent me these videos and whatnot, all these TED Talks and psychology studies on how choice actually screws up the human mind a little bit, that if you have 10 things to choose from, it's actually harder to decide and be satisfied with the choice than if a choice is thrust upon you, right. Where people tend to adapt and be happy with what they have. And I think in some cases, your character's great, but you have an exaggerated sense of how fun that other character is going to be. And as soon as you...
Well, it's a grass is always greener kind of thing.
Exactly. And as soon as that starts to hit you, you start to find dissatisfaction with your character that you wouldn't have felt if you didn't have a backup in place. Now, when I say you here, I don't mean you, Chad. I don't even mean anyone in particular.
You don't mean you, Batman, or something?
No, I do mean Batman. Well, of course. Batman plays only one character.
That's true. And that's Batman.
That's Batman. But I think this goes down to, instead of know your group, know yourself. Mm-hmm. You've got to know... I mean, look, I have a really... really bad habit in video games, especially RPGs like Dragon Age. I went through probably 10 characters, 15 characters up to level 5 before I ever picked one and beat the game. I really have to control my options, because if I don't, I will never be happy with what I have.
Well, one solution that I've used in the past has been to literally let people run two characters. That solves two things. I do this in high lethality games.
Yeah.
Which means A, if their character dies, they have another one that's right there, already in scene, no interruption necessary.
Right.
They can keep playing. The other advantage is that it's a solution for the split party syndrome, because if everyone's playing two characters, it just conveniently happens that one of the characters from every member of the table ends up in each group.
Well, and that's what I had going with my Null Tribe. If Gnarl had died and stayed dead in the plot, I would have fallen back to playing one of his other Nulls that I had already developed and put in the plot. And that does bring us to another issue, which is when a new character dies, you have the question of not only what's going to happen to that player, you know, are they going to get a new character immediately, an NPC, are they going to have to sit out for a while? But you also have the issue of once that new player character shows up, how do you integrate them into the story and the party? And I think, Chad, what you're doing with your character is a great idea. I would always say start by looking at the character's background, because in the background of that character or another character, there may already be a brother, a best friend, something that you can bring in that the group is going to have an in-character reason or, to trust and work with and accept, at least on some level.
Or when you make the background, because this is what I did, because we had agreed that this was going to be a high lethality game, you engineer that character into the background. You engineer somebody. Like, there's a bunch of NPCs in my character's background. I don't expect to see any of them, really. They're just there for the color and the story and the flavor. But I did write a guy who is very mobile, very willing to travel, very adventurous, very, you know, there's a hook to where he can come looking for my character. And, you know, there's all sorts of hooks to where he can come in as both my backup character and as just a straight up NPC. Now, I did run a game one time that was a high lethality game, and one of the characters died. And I'll have to say, Wayne, you asked, you know, what does the player do? What is the logistics of what the player does? His character, boom, you rolled, bad, boom, head crush, killed, crit, whatever, stomped by the dragons, rocks fall, you die, whatever. What do you as a player and the game master do in that moment? 9 times out of 10, what I see in all the games I've been in where that's happened is everyone's like, oh my God, oh, that's crazy, oh my God. And then they're handed a player's handbook. And then they spend the next hour, 2 hours rolling up a character by themselves while everybody's playing a game. And the GM has kind of got half divided attention as the player is like, can I do this? Can I have this? I don't understand what this rule means.
That's the worst approach you can
take. It is. It's the worst approach, but I have a feeling it's the most common. It's the most common that I've seen. It takes the GM half out of the game. It takes the player out of the game. Everybody's trying to...
Well, and the party's also not in carefully dealing with that death.
Yeah.
I mean, assuming there's some degree of role-playing here, when Wayne's character died, this is a guy who is heir to the company, who was the spouse of the tactical officer, who was a major NPC, who had gone to school with and been a adolescent friend of Pat and John's character. I mean, this was, in their world, the equivalent of if Chad was to get killed by a thunderbolt kicking in his cockpit. You know,
cool.
I guess it's a hell of a way to go. But, you know, this is going to have a real-world impact. And also, we don't want to get all black leaf and crazy here, but there was some RP that needed to come out of that.
Yeah.
There was some ways that these characters had to respond to that. And I think if I just handed Wayne a player's handbook, in this case, MechWarrior 2nd Edition, and said, yep, okay, start making a new character, and he's asking me rules questions, and that would never have had a chance to play out. Yeah. Well, and that was some of the best roleplay in this campaign.
And that's why I think you need, like you had mentioned earlier, you know, getting them in back into the action as soon as possible. I think that, you know, really is a sliding scale depending upon, you know, the circumstances within your individual campaign. And while I agree with you that, yeah, you want to get them back in there, you've got to allow for that moment to really play itself out, because it's a significant event that occurs just like any other major campaign event. Of course, it's completely unscripted that this happened, but it's an opportunity to make something out of it, and you don't want to pass that
up. Let me ask you guys this, because you guys are way more rules-oriented than I am. Because to me, it's like, this is a really self-evident answer to the question I'm about to ask here. Character dies. You're in the middle of a scene. You want to role-play this out. Player turns around to the GM and says, okay, I've got a character concept. No stats, no anything. We don't have any of that. It's not made, but I have a character concept. Is it really a bad thing to just let them play?
No. In fact, I did. No. When Wayne brought out his new character, I put him in the action well before he had a character sheet.
Yeah.
And I just said, look, real quick, what's the elevator pitch? Okay, great. If you have to make a save against a skill, I'll just have you roll two dice, and I'll just look at whether they're good or not.
Yeah, right. And I think everyone understood that I don't have it on the character sheet yet, so I don't know what skills he is and isn't going to have. So if something doesn't make sense from one week to the next, we can hand wave a little bit.
Well, and it also
not nitpick that.
Yeah.
You know, I'm a very rules crunchy DM, but I will almost never run a system that I don't know well enough that I could play a character with no character sheet in front of me simply by knowing this is what it is.
Yeah, I play on static NPCs all the time.
In fact, one of my methods of dealing with a character death at the table, if they've got a concept in mind, I'll slide a blank character sheet in front of them, say, put name, put class and level, depending on the system, and just fill out everything else as we go. If you need a dagger, draw a dagger, write the dagger down on your sheet. If you need this skill, write it on there. At the end of the night, we'll go through and make everything right.
Right.
Well, and Wayne, do you feel that you got kind of a try before you buy it thing by being able to play the character for statting him to get a sense of how he plays out?
Yeah, because I was struggling at that point of how is he going to fit in the group? What does the group need skill-wise? And I had a little bit of chance to just kind of build that personality a little bit better, because I said I hadn't fully thought out the personality intentionally. So I was able to come up with what I wanted his personality to be like during the course of the rest of the game. So then when I went home and started doing the numbers between game sessions, I did have a better idea of what I wanted him to look like skill-wise, because I knew how was I playing him, you know, at least for that hour or so. So I also twisted the knife a little bit on the group at that moment. Going into the game, there was very little that I specifically thought about that I wanted going forward with the character that we weren't already working on, my original character, that is. Mm-hmm. And one thing was I wanted him to develop his own family, to have, you know, his own kids to someday leave the company to and things like that. And I thought about how difficult it would be to have the tactical officer suddenly have to leave the field for a couple months because she was pregnant. So it was something I was going to ask Dan about anyway between games. So when my character died, I wrote that on a sheet of paper. I was like, Dan, I was going to ask you for this. I think it'll have even more impact now that he's dead. So as my own little twist of the knife as the character died, his wife suddenly was pregnant, and everyone around the table, as they realized that, kind of jaws started dropping. It's like, I planned on having that happen originally, but now it just meant something completely different. And it was, I think, more impactful than it would have been.
Let me talk about the way your character died a little more. And the reason I want to expound on this is because this is going to set up our next talking point. So where we were at in the battle was the other side had been all but decimated. They had one mech left that was in decent condition, one that was literally just a torso and legs walking. I had no arms, was missing even parts of the torso. They were in a very desperate, angry place, and so they were just going to take everyone they could with them. At this point, the good guys still have some mechs up, have fighters in the air. They're not going to win. And these guys just kept going, and I was just going to make them cost you guys everything they could on the way out. The battle was effectively over. And what happens in what Wayne described in his post as a parting shot, and he is accurate in doing so, was this mech that was just nothing but a pair of legs goes up and starts kicking all the mechs that are down.
It's just insult to injury at that point.
Destroyed one mech doing it, got to your mech, and rolled a kick, rolled location, head, did sufficient damage to basically just bash in the head and crush the pilot within the cockpit. Instant death on what was a meaningless moment.
Yeah, this was not an epic going down in flames, holding the line.
Yeah.
No, it was pretty much over, and here's a...
You were down, and you were just waiting for the battle to be finished. Yeah. And get out of your mech.
Like waiting for it to be safe to get out.
This is like that World War One unit that got decimated after the peace had been declared, because some jackass officer wanted his medal. And, I mean, it was a little different than that culturally, but the end result was the same. All right, now here's the point I'm getting at. The discussion point you brought up was, how do you deal with the accidental consequences of something like this? Now, you put this, however, in positive terms, not consequences negatively, but positively. When you have an unscripted moment that creates these gems of drama and character and plot, and nobody planned this, nobody saw this coming, what do you do as a game master or as a player to capitalize on that?
Whatever you had written for the rest of that session immediately went out the window.
Yes.
Without you having any idea because that this was going
to
happen.
This had to be dealt with, and it was a lot of fun dealing with it. My first take on this would be, don't overplay it. Let it take its course. Deal with it. Don't blow it off. Don't ignore it. Don't get upset you're off script. Run with it. but also don't let it overstay its welcome. If you harp on this for too long, yeah, it was cool to a point. Now it's just grating. It's just going on and on.
There's a point where down tempo or sadness is fun to role play out, that to role play out the sadness and the loss and the grief. But then there's a point where it just becomes morbid.
Yeah, and also you run the risk of surviving party members becoming Batman. Everything from that point on in the campaign. Wait a minute.
What is wrong with that? That sounds awesome.
Well, the reason is
Dan, I want to be Batman.
We all know there's only one Batman.
I'm Batman.
You have four people at the table. Being Batman, you have a problem.
No, they can't be Batman because I'm Batman.
It's Batman Incorporated.
No, it's not. You shut your filthy whore mouth.
Pat will be German Batman. Chad can be Korean Batman.
Korean John's Italian Batman. Batman.
Ginger Batman.
Kim Jong Ginger Batman.
I may have to add that to the game now. To the
ginger Batgirl sandwich. Was a ginger.
True.
But Dr. Who's never
make
been a ginger.
Great Batgirl. Yes, you would.
That's disturbing.
Yes, it is. Stop dying so much, Wayne.
The only other thing I would add to that is, I mean, and what you're talking about is some of the more blatant, obvious moments like that. I would also say, you know, be on the lookout for, you know, the not so obvious moments when they come around, because they do. And you can take the same tactics that you listed or talked about, Dan, and kind of rolling with them. But again, you know, and you have to be very careful about not having these things overstay their welcome, because usually when these smaller moments like that do come up, they're not nearly as significant. They're fun, and they add a nice little twist to the game. But yeah, if they're around too long, it becomes weird and awkward, and just, you know, you get a feeling that it's just not right as it comes up.
Have any of you guys ever had another one of those type moments in your game where you're running the game and suddenly something you just did throws everything out the window you had planned?
Totally.
Always.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
That's every game.
Yeah. Many times, to me, that is the joy of GMing.
Usually it's something the players did, though, not something...
Well, either way. I mean, it goes either way.
Look, hey, I stand by what I said many episodes ago. If there's a GM and three players, you have five forces at the table, the fifth being the dice.
Good save there, Dan. That's masterful.
Yeah.
That's some of that jinx math.
I said this several episodes back, that I consider the dice to be almost like another player, because they have a say on events that I, as the game master, don't generally overrule. And in this battle, I didn't set out to kill Wayne. The dice killed him, so to speak.
It's like writing a book, too, when even if you're not talking about dice or mechanics or anything like that. You know, you have an idea for a story, you maybe take some notes, you have a general outline, but when you actually sit down to type it, which is the running of the game, and suddenly the book takes on a life of its own, and you just get these ideas that, man, we need to go over here instead of doing this, and that happens all the time, unless you are just a rigid notes centric GM, to where you have problems when you start going off script.
That's the joy of gaming to me.
Yeah,
if I run a game or play in a game and at no point am surprised, it was an awful ass game.
Mm-hmm.
For whatever reason, you know, I don't know what force to blame, but it was an awful game, and I am glad to have been surprised.
I take a sort of a perverse joy in being able to predict the actions of my players and have them walk themselves into the traps that I lay.
Well, I think also if you're in a game where you as the DM know exactly what's going to happen at all times, chances are your players hate your game too.
Yeah. You know,
yes.
I've never seen one successfully done that way. And I've tried, believe me. and it was awful.
Which makes me wonder, like, how modules work. I'm talking like the classic, maybe second edition D&D modules, where it's like you start here and you end at the end and you kill the bad guy, and they're so like formulaic, unless you get into weird stuff like...
Well, the beginning and end aren't the important part, it's the middle. Hmm. And, I mean, they provide the same framework as a note-heavy DM's notes do.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they give you the setting, they give you the background for the group to run through, but you don't necessarily hold to the exact letter of what's going on.
You just use it as a guide or an
example. And even if you hold to the exact letter of it, you still have to let the players run around and interact with the environment, and it's going to happen in ways that the people who wrote the module had no idea it was ever going
to
happen.
Yeah, so I always took it to be more of a here's maps, here's NPCs and motivations things, and you go from there.
If it's like resources, then yeah, that's cool. I have run into people, and I know that there are a lot of people out there who do the module thing, and they don't use it as this is a guy
or
this
idea.
This is a resource. No, it's like here is the map. Well, I want to go over here. There is no box text for that. You must return to the map.
And that's actually the frustrating part about trying to write a module
Pat's
like that,
because like,
you know that
days.
Well, you know that stuff's going to happen, but you're restricted within a word count and within just a reasonable expectations count. You can only cover so many scenarios. You're writing for a group of unknowns is what you're doing when you do that. You really have to narrow your choices down to the most obvious ones. If the party does this, this is going to happen. If the party does this, then this is going to affect this encounter down the road. And then leave it at that, and you're going to have to leave it up to the GM, because very rarely does the party actually follow what is written in the module.
And I think that's a problem with how at least those old school modules are written.
I've always wondered how you approach writing a module from that standpoint, because I've thought about doing it, but I'm left with how in the world do you do it without making it be this railroad?
See, when I pick up a module, and like, again, these are the old school ones. I'm sure there's great modules out there, whatever. But the sort of traditional module, it is a format. The way it reads, and it might not be intended to be used like this, or people might not use it like this, but the way it reads is A to B to C. Okay, they go back to A. Here's what happens if they go back to A. Now, C, D, you know, and it keeps going. I like what Wayne said of taking a module and using it as a collection of resources. They're not presented as a collection of resources, though.
Well, I think that modules make a very good entry point for a new DM.
Sure.
And they often do play out as the first A, then B, then C, if D, then E.
Right.
They're the choose-your-own-adventure books of role-playing games.
They are. And I think a lot of people probably started DMing by playing through pre-written modules. Mm-hmm. And I think there was a critical point in almost all of our DMing careers when we reach a point where you're supposed to go E to F, and all of a sudden the party does J squared. And you go, well, what do I do?
There's
and
no box
you have two choices. You can either force them to get back onto the tracks, mm-hmm. or you improvise. And when you make that jump finally to improvisation, you've made the step into a new form of gaming. Mm-hmm. And I mean, that's something that I think a lot of people have done as part of their development. I think, you know, having those modules available made it a whole lot easier for me to get into DMing the first several times I did it.
Oh, I think that's true of almost everybody. It just made it very easy for it was a very good gateway drug to give you that idea that this is kind of what we think the game should go like. You can do it this way if you want, but if you really want to go ahead and do it a different way, go ahead. But this will help you get your feet wet so then you can go diving later on.
I think the problem with it, though, is that it genericizes it. It presents it you does. With saying, this is how it should be. Even if you go into improv, even if you start branching out from it, the modules, it says you need to operate within this framework.
With the old school stuff, it gave you a starting point to give you an idea of how the game operated. Mm-hmm. And this is back when rule books weren't necessarily written very well.
Yeah. Oh, and you know, I
and so
that.
you didn't have that really cheesy example of the text in there where they would say, you know, this is how a normal session might go. You had no idea how that was. The only way you learned was either from other people or you just kind of, you know, you had that pre-published adventure that you just went and did on your own.
Yeah, I've
talked to people that GM that just don't want to do that initial prep. You know, they're not that they're not creative people, but they're not big picture. I don't want to create the world and the beginning plot. Mm-hmm. And they grab modules as a way to start it. And then from there, they react to what the players do in the game's all about how the players are running. But it's their starting point because they don't want to build the world. That's not the part of GMing that's interesting to them.
It's Bisquick as opposed to making them from scratch.
Yeah, I just think that this is me looking back with the experience of time on my side, looking back at modules that were written in the 80s here. But I just wish that they were more resource kits. I wish that they had like...
You know what? Actually, FASA's old Shadowrun a lot of the Shadowrun adventures that they published were much better in that sense, where you had the initial encounter and things to kind of get the action moving. But then they did a good job of dropping a number of different clues that weren't necessarily literally dependent. You could go from A to D, and then jump back over to B, and then jump over to C, or then maybe to F. And you didn't have to go in an order. And everything still kind of played out, you know, pretty well in the
end. My memory of Shadowrun modules, although they weren't quite modules, they were more combat scenarios. They were like, here is a map of like a Quickie Mart or something. Here's the people who are in it. Here's some stats for the gangbangers that are going to rob it. Here's maybe one or two plot hook type, tiny little itty bitty baby plot hooks in there. And
here's three charts to roll on to see what explodes with every bullet that misses.
Yes.
I'm sold. Can we do this as a Drunken New Year game?
What version of Shadowrun did you guys play? Because I don't remember them being
what
that
he's describing at all. It's the adventure from the back of the first second edition. Is it first edition?
Yeah.
Well, you're also describing the pre-pub thing that was in the rule book to kind of get you going. When you describe it, I'm like, oh yeah, he's talking about the milk run or whatever.
The milk run. Like I was saying, though, I if somebody is going to write a module, put in resources, put in some story hook ideas, put in maybe a section on advice on this is ambiance, this is how you set up a game, this is here's an example of play of kind of how it goes along. I think that a new GM would benefit more from a sort of GMing for dummies or a guidebook on GMing rather than relying on modules, because it teaches you one way to run the game. Sure, people branch out from that all the time, and we all did, but I just think that they really genericized
The fact that I think that we all branched out, though, shows that that's not necessarily a bad place to start. And there's nothing wrong with what you're proposing either. But the fact that it showed us that you can do it this way, but then, like I said earlier, you realize that, well, I can actually really go and do it this way and probably have a lot more fun doing
thing
it.
The thing is, I don't know if that's necessarily the case.
If you don't have that place to start from, you're not going to
Because know. Dungeons & Dragons is the number one hugest, gigantic, biggest game out there. And the Dungeon Run is sort of the de facto way to play that game.
I don't know that that's really as true as you might think. I mean, that's what's out there as far as goods for sale. Because they're easy to produce and people will buy them. Nobody wants to buy DMing for Dummies.
Right.
Somebody made that, actually. And
it's probably pretty awful. Yeah. I don't mean literally.
But, I mean, people buy dungeons. They're easy to make. They're clean. They're simple. They're precise. And they're easy for people who are out of an idea for a story. They can reach back on their shelf. They can grab a module. And there it is. We can run it. And we can play tonight. I bet that if you were to actually put a secret camera into your average gaming table, even one where they're playing modern D&D, I bet you're not going to find the bare bones raw dungeon crawl that you see in modules. I bet that's just not the standard.
I don't know.
I could be wrong.
But when I go to like gaming shops and I see people playing in local gaming shops,
probably watching a lot of strangers play, though. People who don't know each other.
That's a completely different issue altogether, because you need either those Pathfinder Society things or living RPGA crap.
Then that's just it, too. I mean, look at the number one role-playing game out there is Dungeons & Dragons. Look at its number one competitor, Pathfinder. Not saying that this is bad. I'm just saying, look at the largest role-playing game play organizations. Dungeon-type, generic, sort of standard games. I mean, it gets back to my thing. I hate that D&D is the number one role-playing game in the world.
Personally, all it says to me is that fantasy is a very popular setting right now.
Well,
has been in role-playing games.
That's a setting. It's a very specific way of playing. It's a very specific approach to how you play a role playing. Right.
What it says to me is that it has name recognition and that Wayne died. And that's a problem.
Yes.
And we're going to blame D&D for that.
Let's roll this way back off that tangent. Back to, I do understand how we got there.
It's because we're a D&D podcast, right?
Mostly me.
We're talking about player and GM surprise and the plot going in unusual directions, which led to a passing comment, I believe. somebody will
see. It led to modules, and modules led there.
How do modules, how do people play modules
get restricted from? In Art Imitating Life, this podcast went in strange, unexpected directions as well.
So I let it run for a while, and now it's overstayed its welcome, so I'm getting us back on the plot.
So what you're saying, it's one of those unscripted moments that we let stick around too long?
No, I don't think so. It was an interesting discussion, but now we've reached too long, so it's time to move on. But, Wayne, the other point you raised, the third and final point, was about managing player morale. And on this topic, you were very careful to emphasize you are not talking about in-character morale. You are talking about table morale. When a character dies, because of the fact that it is something someone at that table developed, hopefully was at least a little bit attached to, when that character dies, then look, just like when you're watching a movie and the good guys get handed a defeat, if you're invested in that movie, that has an emotional impact on you. You're revved up because you want revenge. You're depressed because you can't believe that so-and-so just died in the arms of his lover, whatever. And in the same way around a table, the players are going to have a reaction. Yeah,
when that Union dropship died, we all felt like we got kicked in the balls.
Oh, and it wasn't just Union dropship. You guys lost the battle. You had to walk off that field with your mechs basically fine, but flying the white flag of surrender because you had lost. And that has an impact on group morale. Now, character death does as well. When your character died, that had an impact on the emotional tenor of the story being told and therefore of the people around the table. So
from that point on, the entire tone of the campaign has changed. That was a watershed event during the course of the campaign.
How do you feel it's changed? I agree with you, but I'm curious what your take is on it.
It's taken a much more serious tone from that point. There were other things that happened around that event as well. But before then, it was a struggling group trying to get along. It wasn't...
There's a sense of innocence to it.
Yes. That was the moment where suddenly everything just became real. It's hard to say that a role-playing game is suddenly everything just became real in a game. But from a campaign standpoint, yeah, there was a big innocence that no matter how bad things get, at least the characters are going to walk away from it. And from that point on, the whole tone, the way everyone's played their characters... Suddenly, everyone just sobered up. Instantly, the campaign got much more serious. And I'm enjoying the way it has changed. It definitely feels like a different game.
I think it's going to swing back the other way, though, too. I agree with you, Wayne. It has become much more serious. But I think given a couple more sessions, after we get beyond the heavy emotions of what's happened, I see that we'll sort of move back more toward a center of what we were doing before. And I don't say that what we were doing before was really haphazard and carefree, but I do think that a really hardcore serious game, I like it to go for, you know, maybe a session or two that way, but then I honestly don't want to play this campaign, the entire campaign, to be that emotionally heavy. I like to go from back and forth. I want some really heavy emotional stuff. Then I want to go some lighthearted stuff, some fun, lots of sex, you know, so there we go. And I think that I think that we're going to get back.
I think you need an actual play when you do that.
Yeah, exactly.
Because nothing's better than watching Pat and Dan flirt with each other. Just
it's going well beyond flirting.
Yes,
and
I'm waiting for the LARPing action between you two.
Oh, it happens.
I'm sure. It's just extra credit stuff. That's why he has a few more skill points than you guys do.
Yep.
But Wayne, one of the things that you noted in writing this topic out was you observe that there's something that I do, which is I'm always careful never to end a game on a down note.
Yeah.
And now the down note is somewhat subjective because there are several ways to respond to defeat or setback. One of them is to be uniquely energized. The other is to just feel like all the air got let out of your tires. And when the latter happens, you're correct in your observation that unless it's just 3 a.m. and everybody has to be at work in 2 hours, we're not ending the game there.
Yeah, and specifically what I was talking about with that wasn't that the game itself never ends on a down note or something bad happening. You never let the group, us as players,
right,
end on that emotional low. Because at that point, then coming in next week, we wouldn't be looking forward to the game as much.
There has to be, even in the face of defeat and struggle, there has to be some sense of hope and purpose. And that's what I always try to reestablish. You know, you guys had that defeat on the other planet. Nobody died, but I mean, you got humiliated and lost some major assets and blah, blah, blah. And I did not want to end the game there because I didn't want you to spend a whole week demoralized, defeated, thinking, you know, when we come back next session, we get to start with going off planet, the white flag still flying. And I was so grateful that one of the players, we'll call him Chad, didn't throw in a towel as like, no, we have a job. I don't know how I'm going to do this, but I'm grabbing a taxi and I'm going to go figure this out. Because like, yes, thank you. Because I had alternate ways of solving this written out and it let me grab back onto that. And the game ended at a very different place where suddenly the group had a plan. There was a way to move forward. You know, everyone was recongregating. And in the same way, you know, Wayne, when your character died, we couldn't end it there. You know, I had to have something else happen. Though, I mean, I guess maybe in that case, it would have made a somewhat dramatic close of the mech gets kicked in. There's blood trickling out of what's left of the cockpit. And it's just kind of this stunning cliffhanger. Because at that point, even though there had been a major loss, the character morale was down, but I did not get the sense that player morale was down.
It wasn't the same as when we lost the Union. When we lost the Union, you could see the looks on everyone around the table. You know, we felt like, okay, the company, the in-game company, has just lost. How will this company ever survive? Will this campaign survive as it is? And we didn't really have that sense in this moment that we had then, because it was a different kind of situation.
Sure. Chris, in the 31st century... Come on, can you finish this for me?
Life is cheap. Battle mechs aren't.
That's right.
Forget battle mechs. Unions aren't, man.
Yeah, true
unions
words.
Are more expensive than battle mechs.
As I was digging through my old posters to hang up today, one of the ones I found that I got back when I was working at my friendly local game store was a poster for Steve Jackson's Hot Lead, which was going to be their Universal Miniatures rules. Which kind of became like the Duke Nukem, I guess, of miniatures rules. And they were never published.
It never existed. Yeah.
It never existed.
Okay, so this was like GURPS for minis. I got you. All right.
Yeah, basically. And so I have two different posters of it. But the interesting side note to this, and I think it's still there, because I remember I posted on the forums about this, there is a link on Amazon for these rules. And people, myself included, have commented about these rules and how amazing they are, even though they don't exist. I tried to get people on there to make it like the Three Wolf Moon T-shirt thing for gaming, but it never quite happened. So maybe we should try it again, because a copy on the poster, they take it, you know, direct slams at Games Workshop, which I find incredibly amusing. But yeah,
Chris, you have to give me a link to that. I am going to post that in the show notes. We're going to see what comes of this.
I'll see if I can find it.
Awesome. Well, I think that's going to wrap it up for this episode. Man, maybe a bunch of random crap in the show notes. And Lunar, thank you again for the awesome picture. And thank you to everyone that participated in the Forum of Secret Santa stuff.
Oh, by the way, Lunar, he got it.
I already talked to her about it. She's like, did you get it? I haven't heard anything. I'm like, yeah, because I was going to wait to comment on it on an episode. But yes, I did get it. She was already gotten destroyed in the mail. Which is a distinct possibility, but no, it did not get stored in the mail. So, as for the rest of you guys, you have great games and a wonderful week and a...
And quit killing Wayne's character.
And kill all of Wayne's characters you can. And we will catch you guys next time.
See ya.
I'm Batman.
This has been a production of Fear the Boot, copyright 2012. Listeners are free to use this show in any non-commercial endeavor as long as credit is provided to feartheboot.com. You can find previous episodes and other resources at feartheboot.com. Fear the Boot is also a member of the Pulp Gamer Media Network of shows. You can find other great shows in this network at pulpgamer.com.